So his father was...
My editor at the magazine, yes, Frank Aldrich. He was significantly older than I was, and married. And I'm afraid that was my son's other great resentment. It was rather hard for him at school. People were different about these things then.
When did you last see him? Your son, I mean.
That would be 1987, the year he married. I found out about it after the event and wrote him a letter telling him how hurt I was that he hadn't included me. And he told me in no uncertain terms that I had long since relinquished any right to be included in anything to do with his life.
We sat in silence for a moment. Her face was perfectly still, and it was impossible to tell what she was thinking, or even if she was now simply focused on the television. I didn't know what to say to her. I couldn't find any words that were up to a hurt that great. But then she turned to me.
And that was it. My mother died a couple of years later, and she was my last point of contact with him. I do sometimes wonder how he is, if he's even alive, whether he had children. I wrote to him for a while, but over the years I suppose I've become rather philosophical about the whole thing. He was quite right, of course. I had no right to him, really, to anything to do with his life.
But he was your son, I whispered.
He was, but I hadn't really behaved like a mother, had I?
She took a shaky breath.
I've had a very good life, Louisa. I loved my job, and I worked with some wonderful people. I traveled to Paris, Milan, Berlin, London, far more than most women my age. I had my beautiful apartment and some excellent friends. You mustn't worry about me. All this nonsense about women having it all. We never could, and we never shall. Women always have to make the difficult choices. But there is a great consolation in simply doing something you love.
We sat in silence digesting this. Then she placed her hands squarely on her knees.
Actually, dear girl, would you help me to my bathroom? I'm feeling quite tired, and I think I might take myself to bed.
That night I lay awake thinking about what she had told me. I thought about Agnes, and the fact that these two women, living yards away from each other, both cloaked in a very specific sadness, might, in another world, have been a comfort to each other. I thought about the fact that there seemed to be such a high cost to anything a woman chose to do with her life, unless she simply aimed low. But I knew that already, didn't I? I had come here, and it had cost me dear. Often in the small hours I conjured Will's voice, telling me not to be ridiculous and melancholy, but to think instead of all the things I'd achieved. I lay in the dark and ticked off my achievements on my fingers. I had a home, for the time being at least. I had paid employment. I was still in New York, and I was among friends. I had a new relationship, even if sometimes I wondered how I had ended up in it. Could I really say that I would have done things any differently? But it was the old woman in the next room I was thinking of when I finally slept. There were 14 sporting trophies on Josh's shelf, 4 of them the size of my head, for American football, baseball, something called track and field, and a junior trophy for a spelling bee. I'd been there before, but it was only now, sober and unhurried, that I was able to take in my surroundings and the scale of his achievements. There were pictures of him in sporting garb, preserved at the moment of his triumphs, his arms clasped around his teammates, those perfect teeth in a perfect smile. I thought of Patrick and the multitude of certificates on the wall of his apartment, and wondered at the male need to display achievements, like a peacock permanently shimmering its tail. When Josh put the phone down, I jumped.
"It's only takeout. I'm afraid with everything at work I don't have time for anything else right now. But this is the best Korean food south of Koreatown."
"I don't mind," I said. I had no other Korean food experiences to judge it by. I was just enjoying the prospect of coming to see him. Walking to catch the subway south, I had relished the novelty of heading downtown, without battling either Siberian winds, deep snow, or torrential icy rain. And Josh's apartment was not quite the rabbit hutch he'd described, unless your rabbit had decided to move into a renovated loft in an area that had apparently once housed artist studios, but now formed a base for four different versions of Marc Jacobs, punctuated by artisan jewellers, specialist coffee shops and boutiques that employed men with earpieces on the doorstep. It was all whitewashed walls and oak floors, with a modernistic marble table and a distressed leather sofa. The smattering of a few carefully chosen ornaments and pieces of furniture suggested everything had been carefully considered, sourced and earned, perhaps through the services of an interior designer. He had brought me flowers, a delicious mix of hyacinths and freesias. "What are these for?" I said. He shrugged as he shepherded me in.
"I just saw them on the way home from work and thought you might like them."
"Wow, thank you," I inhaled deeply. "This is the nicest thing that's happened to me in ages."
"The flowers or me?"
He raised an eyebrow. "Well, I suppose you are quite nice." I had forgotten that Americans don't really do irony. His face fell. "You're amazing, and I love them." He smiled broadly then and kissed me.
"Well, you're the nicest thing that's happened to me in ages," he said softly when he pulled back. "Feels like I waited a long time for you, Louisa."
"We only met in October."
"Ah, but we live in an age of instant gratification, and we're in the city where anything you want, you get yesterday."
There was a strange potency to being wanted as much as Josh seemed to want me. I wasn't quite sure what I'd done to deserve it. I wanted to ask him what he saw in me, but I suspected it would sound oddly needy to say it aloud, so I tried to work it out in other ways. "Tell me about the other women you've dated," I said from the sofa, as he moved around the little kitchenette, pulling out plates and cutlery and glasses. "What were they like?"
"Aside from Tinder hookups? Smart, pretty, usually successful."
He stooped to pull a bottle of fish sauce from the back of a cupboard.
"But honestly, like, self-obsessed," he said. "Like they couldn't be seen without perfect makeup, or would have a full-on meltdown if their hair wasn't right. And everything had to be Instagrammed, or photographed, or reported on social media and presented in the best light, including dates with me. Like they could never drop their guard."
He straightened up, holding bottles.
"You want chili sauce or soy?" "I dated one girl who used to check what time I was getting up each day, and set her alarm for half an hour before it just so she could fix her hair and makeup. Just so I would never see her not looking perfect. Even if it meant getting up at, like, 4:30.
"Okay, I'm going to warn you. I'm not that girl."
"I know that, Louisa.
I've put you to bed." I kicked off my shoes and folded my legs under me. "I suppose it's kind of impressive that they put in so much effort."
"Yeah, but it can be a little exhausting. And you never feel quite like you know what's really underneath. With you, I have to say, it's all pretty much out there. You are who you are."
"Should I take that as a compliment?"
"Sure. You're like the girls I grew up with. You're honest."
"The Gopniks don't think so."
"Fuck them."
His voice was uncharacteristically harsh.
"You know, I've been thinking about it. You can prove you didn't do what they said you did, right? So you should sue them for unfair dismissal and loss of reputation and hurt feelings and..."
I shook my head.
"Seriously, Gopnik trades on this reputation of being a decent, old-fashioned, good guy in business, and he's always doing stuff for charity. But he fired you for nothing, Louisa. You lost your job and your home with no warning and no compensation."
He thought I was stealing.
"Yeah, but he must know there was something not quite right about what he was doing, or he would have called the cops. Given who he is, I bet there is some lawyer who would take this on a no-win, no-fee basis."
"Really, I'm fine. Lawsuits aren't my style."
"Yeah, well, you're too nice. You're being English about it."
The doorbell rang. Josh held up a finger as if to say we would continue this conversation. He disappeared into the narrow hallway, and I heard him paying the delivery boy while I finished laying the little table.
"And you know what?" he said, bringing the bag into the kitchen. "Even if you didn't have evidence, I'd bet Gopnik would pay a lump sum just to stop the whole thing getting into the papers. Think what that could do for you. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, you were sleeping on someone's floor."
I hadn't told him about sharing Nathan's bed. This could get you a decent deposit on a rental. Hell, you could get a good enough lawyer. This could buy you an apartment. You know how much money Gopnik has? Like, he is famously rich in a city of seriously rich people.
Josh, I know you mean well, but I just want to forget it.
Louisa, you know.
I put my hands down on the table. I'm not suing anybody. He waited for a minute, perhaps frustrated by his inability to push me further. And then he shrugged and smiled.
Okay, well, dinner time. You don't have any allergies, right? Have some chicken. Here. You like eggplant? They do this eggplant chili dish that is just the greatest.
I slept with Josh that night. I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't vulnerable, and I wasn't breathless with need for him. I think I just wanted my life to feel normal again, and we had eaten and drunk and talked and laughed until late into the night, and he had pulled the drapes and turned down the lights, and it seemed like a natural progression, or at least I could think of no reason not to. He was so beautiful. He had skin without a blemish and cheekbones you could actually see, and his hair was soft and chestnut-coloured, and tinged with tiny flecks of gold, even after the long winter. We kissed on his sofa, first sweetly and then with increasing fervour, and he lost his shirt and then I lost mine, and I made myself focus on this gorgeous, attentive man, this prince of New York, or not on all the rambling things my imagination tended to focus on. And I felt need grow in me, like a distant, reassuring friend, until I was able to block out everything but the sensations of him against me, and then, sometime later, inside me. Afterwards, he kissed me tenderly and asked me if I was happy, then murmured that he had to get some sleep. And I lay there and tried to ignore the tears that inexplicably trickled from the corners of my eyes into my ears. What was it Will had told me? You had to seize the day. You had to embrace opportunities as they came. You had to be the kind of person who said yes. If I had turned Josh away, wouldn't I have regretted it forever? I turned silently in the unfamiliar bed and studied his profile as he slept, the perfect straight nose and the mouth that looked like Will's. I thought of all the ways Will would have approved of him. I could even picture them together, laughing with each other, a competitive edge to their jokes. They might have been friends, or enemies. They were almost too similar. Perhaps I was meant to be with this man, I thought, albeit via a strange, unsettling route. Perhaps this was Will, come back to me. And with this thought, I wiped my eyes and fell into a brief, disjointed sleep.
Chapter 24. From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com to catclark1@yahoo.com. Dear Treen, I know you think it's too soon, but what did Will teach me? You only get one life, right? And you're happy with Eddie, so why can't I be happy? You'll get it when you meet him, I promise. So this is the kind of man Josh is. Yesterday he took me to the best bookshop in Brooklyn and bought me a bunch of paperbacks he thought I might like. Then at lunchtime he took me to a posh Mexican restaurant on East 46th and made me try fish tacos. Don't pull a face, they were absolutely delicious. Then he told me he wanted to show me something. No, not that. We walked to the Grand Central Terminal, and it was packed, as usual, and I was thinking, okay, bit weird, are we going on a trip? Then he told me to stand with my head in the corner of this archway just by this oyster bar. I laughed at him, I thought he was joking, but he insisted, told me to trust him. So there I am, standing with my head in the corner of this huge masonry archway, with all the commuters coming and going around me, trying not to feel like a complete idiot. And when I look round, he's walking away from me. But then he stops diagonally across from me, maybe 50 feet away, and he puts his own face in the corner, and suddenly, above all the noise and chaos and rumbling trains, I hear, murmured into my ear, like he was right beside me, "Louisa Clark, you are the cutest girl in the whole of New York City." Treen, it was like witchcraft. I looked up and he turned around and smiled, and I have no idea how it worked. But he walked across and just took me in his arms and kissed me in front of everyone. And someone whistled at us. And it was honestly the most romantic thing that has ever happened to me. So yes, I'm moving on. And Josh is amazing. It would be nice if you could be pleased for me. Give Tom a big kiss. L. Kiss. Weeks passed, and New York, as it did with most things, careered into spring at a million miles an hour, with little subtlety and a lot of noise. The traffic grew heavier, the streets were thicker with people, and each day the grid around our block became a cacophony of noise and activity that barely dimmed until the small hours. I stopped wearing a hat and gloves to the library protests. Dean Martin's padded coat was laundered and went into the cupboard. The park grew green. Nobody suggested I move out. Margot, in lieu of any kind of helper's wage, pressed so many items of clothing on me that I had to stop admiring things in front of her because I became afraid she would feel obliged to give me more. Over the weeks, I observed that she might share an address with the Gopniks, but that was where the similarity between them ended. She survived, as my mother would have said, on shirt buttons.
Between the healthcare bills and the maintenance fees, I don't know where they think I'm meant to find the money to feed myself, she remarked, as I handed her another letter, hand-delivered by the management company.
The envelope said, Open, legal action pending. She wrinkled her nose and put it neatly in a pile on the sideboard, where it would stay for the next couple of weeks, unless I opened it. She grumbled often about the maintenance fees, which totaled thousands of dollars a month, and seemed to have reached a point at which she had decided to ignore them, because there was nothing else she could do. She told me she had inherited the apartment from her grandfather, an adventurous sort, the only person in her family who didn't believe that a woman should restrict her sights to husband and children.
My father was furious that he had been bypassed. He didn't talk to me for years. My mother tried to broker an agreement, but by then there were the other issues.
She sighed. She bought her groceries from a local convenience store, a tiny supermarket that operated on tourist prices, because it was one of the few places she could walk to. I put a stop to that, and twice a week headed over to a fairway on East 86th Street, where I loaded up on basics to the tune of about a third of what she had been spending. If I didn't cook, she ate almost nothing sensible herself, but bought good cuts of meat for Dean Martin, or poached him white fish in milk, because it's good for his digestion. I think she had become accustomed to my company. Plus, she was so wobbly that I think we both knew she couldn't manage alone any more. I wondered how long it took someone of her age to get over the shock of surgery. I also wondered what she would have done if I hadn't been there. "What will you do?" I said, motioning toward the pile of bills.
"Oh, I'll ignore those," she waved a hand. "I'm leaving this apartment in a box. I have nowhere to go, and no one to leave it to, and that crook Ovitz knows it. I think he's just sitting tight until I die, and then he'll claim the apartment under the non-payment of maintenance fees clause and make a fortune selling it to some dot-com person or awful CEO, like that fool across the corridor."
"Maybe I could help. I have some savings from my time with the Gopniks. I mean, just to get you through a couple of months. You've been so kind to me." She hooted.
"Dear girl, you couldn't meet the maintenance fees on my guest bathroom."
For some reason, this made her laugh so heartily that she coughed until she had to sit down. But I sneaked a look at the letter after she went to bed. Its late payment charges, its direct contravention of the terms of your lease, and threat of compulsory eviction made me think that Mr. Ovitz might not be as beneficent or patient as she seemed to think. I was still walking Dean Martin four times a day, and during those trips to the park, I tried to think what could be done for Margot. The thought of her being evicted was appalling. Surely the managing agent wouldn't do that to a convalescent elderly woman. Surely the other residents would object. Then I remembered how swiftly Mr. Gopnik had evicted me, and how insulated the inhabitants of each apartment were from each other's lives. I wasn't entirely sure they'd even notice. I was standing on Sixth Avenue, peering at a wholesale underwear store when it hit me. The girls at the Emporium might not sell Chanel and Yves Saint Laurent, but they would if they could get it, or would know some dress agency that could. Margot had innumerable designer labels in her collection, things I was sure the collectors would pay serious money for. There were handbags alone that must be worth thousands of dollars. I took Margot to meet them under the guise of an outing. I told her it was a beautiful day, and that we should go further than usual and build up her strength with fresh air. She told me not to be so ridiculous, and nobody had breathed fresh air in Manhattan since 1937. But she climbed into the taxi without too much complaint, and Dean Martin on her lap, we made our way to the East Village, where she frowned up at the concrete storefront as if somebody had asked her to enter a slaughterhouse for fun.
"What have you done to your arms?"
Margot paused at the checkout and gazed at Lydia's skin. Lydia was wearing an emerald-green puffed-sleeve shirt, and her arms displayed three neatly traced Japanese koi carp in orange, jade, and blue.
"Oh, my tats! You like 'em?"
Lydia put her cigarette in her other hand and raised her arm toward the light.
"If I wanted to look like a navvy."
I began to shepherd Margot to a different part of the shop. "Here, Margot, see, they have all their vintage clothes in different areas. If you have clothes from the 1960s, they go here, and over there, the 1950s. It's a little like your apartment."
"It's nothing like my apartment."
"I just mean they trade in outfits like yours. It's quite a successful line of business these days." Margot pulled at the sleeve of a nylon blouse, then peered at the label over the top of her spectacles.
"Amy Armistead is an awful line. Never could stand the woman. Or Le Grand Folie. Their buttons always fell off. Cheap on thread."
"There are some really special dresses back here, under plastic." I walked over to the cocktail gown section where the best of the women's pieces were displayed. I pulled out a Saks Fifth Avenue dress in turquoise, trimmed with sequins and beads at the hem and cuffs, and held it up against myself, smiling. Margot peered at it, then turned the price tag in her hand. She pulled a face at the figure.
"Who on earth would pay this?"
"People who love good clothes," said Lydia, who had appeared behind us. She was chewing noisily on a piece of gum, and I could see Margot's eyes flicker slightly every time her jaws met.
"There's an actual market for them?"
"A good market," I said, "especially for things in immaculate condition like yours. All Margot's outfits have been kept in plastic and air conditioning. She has things that date back to the 1940s.
"Those aren't mine. Those are my mother's," she said stiffly.
"Seriously, what do you got?"
said Lydia, giving Margot's coat a visible up and down. Margot was in a Jaeger three-quarter-length wool coat and a black fur hat the shape of a large Victoria sponge. Even though the weather was almost balmy, she still appeared to feel the cold.
"What do I have? Nothing I want to send here, thank you."
"But Margot, you have some really fine suits, the Chanels and the Givenchys that no longer fit you. And you have scarves. Bags, you could sell those to specialist dealers, auction houses even."
"Chanel makes serious money," said Lydia sagely. "Especially purses. If it's not too shabby, a decent Chanel, double flap and caviar leather will make 2,500 to 4,000. A new one's going to cost you much more. You know what I'm saying? Python, whoa, the sky's the limit."
"You have more than one Chanel handbag, Margot," I pointed out. Margot tucked her Hermes alligator bag more tightly under her arm.
"You got more like that? We can sell them for you, Mrs. DeWitt. We got a waiting list for the good stuff. I got a lady in Asbury Park will pay up to $5,000 for a decent Hermes."
Lydia reached out to run a finger down the side of it, and Margot pulled it away as if she'd assaulted her.
"It's not stuff," she said. "I don't own stuff."
"I just think it might be worth considering. There seems to be quite a bit you don't use any longer. You could sell it, pay the maintenance fees, and then you could, you know, relax."
"I am relaxed," she snapped, "and I'll thank you not to discuss my financial affairs in public, as if I'm not even here. Oh, I don't like this place. It smells of old people. Come on, Dean Martin. I need some fresh air."
I followed her out, mouthing an apology at Lydia, who shrugged, unconcerned. I suspected that even the faint possibility of Margot's wardrobe coming her way had softened any natural tendency towards combativeness. We caught a taxi back in silence. I was annoyed with myself for my lack of diplomacy, and simultaneously irritated with Margot for her out-and-out rejection of what I had thought was quite a sensible plan. She refused to look at me during the whole journey. I sat beside her, Dean Martin panting beside us, and rehearsed arguments in my head until her silence became unnerving. I glanced sideways and saw an old woman who had just come out of hospital. I had no right to pressure her into anything.
"I didn't mean to upset you, Margot," I said, as I helped her out in front of her building. "I just thought it might be a way forward, you know, with the debts and everything. I just don't want you to lose your home.
Margot straightened up and adjusted her fur hat with a brittle hand. Her voice was querulous, almost tearful, and I realized she had also been rehearsing an argument in her head for the entire 50 blocks or so.
You don't understand, Louisa. These are my things. My babies. They may be old clothes, potential financial assets, to you, but they are precious to me. They are my history. Beautiful, prized remnants of my life.
I'm sorry.
I wouldn't send them to that grubby second-hand shop if I were on my knees. And the thought of seeing a perfect stranger walking towards me on the street in an outfit I loved, I would feel utterly wretched. No. I know you were trying to help, but no.
She turned and waved off my outstretched hand, waiting instead for a shook to help her to the lift. Despite our occasional misfires, Margot and I were quite content that spring. In April, as promised, Lily came to New York accompanied by Mrs. Traynor. They stayed at the Ritz-Carlton a few blocks away and invited Margot and me for lunch. Having them there together made me feel as if a threaded darning needle was quietly drawing the different parts of my life together. Mrs. Traynor, with her diplomat's good manners, was delightful to Margot, and they found a common ground over the history of the building and of New York in general. At lunch, I saw another Margot, quick-witted, knowledgeable, enlivened by new company. Mrs. Traynor, it emerged, had come here for her honeymoon in 1978, and they discussed restaurants, galleries, and exhibitions of the time. Mrs. Traynor talked of her time as a magistrate, and Margot discussed the office politics of the 1970s, and they laughed heartily in a way that suggested we younger people couldn't possibly understand. We ate salad and a small portion of fish wrapped in prosciutto. I noticed that Margot had a tiny forkful of everything, sliding the rest to one side, and despaired quietly of ever getting her to fill any of her clothes again. Lily, meanwhile, leant into me and quizzed me about where she could go that didn't involve either old people or any kind of cultural improvement. Granny has packed these 4 days absolutely full of educational crap. I've got to go to the Museum of Modern Art and some botanical gardens and all sorts, which is fine, blah, blah, if you like all that. But I really want to go clubbing and get wrecked and go shopping. I mean, this is New York. I've already spoken with Mrs. Traynor, and I'm taking you out tomorrow while she catches up with a cousin of hers. Seriously? Oh, thank God. I'm going backpacking in Vietnam in the long vac. Did I tell you? I want to get some decent cut-off shorts, something I can wear for weeks and it won't matter if they don't get washed. And maybe an old biker jacket, something good and battered. Who are you going with, a friend? I raised an eyebrow. You sound like Granny. Well? A boyfriend. And then, as I opened my mouth, but I don't want to say anything about him. Why? I'm delighted you have a boyfriend. It's lovely news. I lowered my voice. You know, the last person who got cagey like that was my sister, and she was basically hiding the fact that she was about to come out. I am not coming out. I do not want to go rooting about in someone's lady garden. Ugh. I tried not to laugh. Lily, you don't have to keep everything close to your chest. We all just want you to be happy. It's okay if people know your business. Granny does know my business, as you so quaintly call it. Then why can't you tell me? I thought you and I could tell each other anything. Lily bore the resigned expression of someone cornered. She sighed theatrically and put down her knife and fork. She looked at me as if braced for a fight. Because it's Jake.
Jake?
Sam's Jake?
The restaurant ground to a gentle halt around me. I forced myself into a smile.
Okay. Wow. She scowled. I knew you'd react like that. Look, it just happened. And it's not like we talk about you all the time or anything. I just ran into him a couple of times. You know, we met at that letting go thing for that cringy grief counselling group you used to go to. We got on okay and we liked each other. Well, we sort of get each other's situations, so we're going backpacking together in the summer.
No biggie.
My brain was spinning. Has Mrs. Traynor met him?
Yes, he comes to ours and I go to his.
She looked almost defensive.
So you see a lot of...
his dad? I mean, I do see Ambulance Sam,
but I mostly see Jake's dad. He was okay, but still quite depressed and eats about a ton of cake a week, which is stressing Jake out a lot. That's partly why we want to get away from everything, just for 6 weeks or so. She kept talking, but a low hum had started somewhere in the back of my head, and I couldn't quite register what she was saying. I didn't want to hear about Sam, even vicariously. I didn't want to hear about people I loved playing happy families without me while I was thousands of miles away. I didn't want to know about Sam's happiness, or Katie with her sexy mouth, or how they were no doubt living in his house together in a newly built den of passion and tangled matching uniforms. "So how's your new boyfriend?" she said. "Josh! Josh! He's great! Totally great!" I put my knife and fork neatly to the side of my plate. Just dreamy. "So, what's going on? I need to see pictures of you with him." "You're massively annoying not being on Facebook or Instagram. Don't you have any pictures of him on your phone?" "Nope," I said, and she wrinkled her nose as if that were a completely inadequate response. I wasn't telling the truth. I had one of the two of us at a pop-up rooftop restaurant taken a week earlier, but I didn't want her to know that Josh was the spitting image of her father. It would either unbalance her or, worse, having her acknowledge it out loud would unbalance me. "So when are we heading out of this funeral parlour? We can leave the olds here to finish their lunch, surely?" Lily nudged me. The two women were still chatting. "Did I tell you I'd been winding Grandpa up massively about Granny's imaginary heartthrob boyfriend? I told him they were going on holiday to the Maldives, and that Granny had been to Rigby Impella to stock up on new underwear. I swear he's about to break down and declare he still loves her. It's making me die laughing." Much as I loved Lily, I was grateful that Mrs. Trainor's packed schedule of cultural improvements over the next few days meant that, aside from our shopping trip, we had limited time together. Her presence in the city, with her intimate knowledge of Sam's life, had created a vibration in the air that I didn't know how to dispel. I was grateful that Josh was flat out with work and didn't notice if I was down or distracted. But Margot noticed, and one night, when her beloved Wheel of Fortune had finished, and I rose to take Dean Martin for his last walk of the night, she asked me straight out what the matter was. I told her. I couldn't think of a reason not to.
"You still love the other one," she said.
"You sound like my sister," I said.
"I don't. I just loved him so much when I did. And the end of it was so awful, and I thought that being over here and living a different life would insulate me from it. I don't do social media anymore. I don't want to keep tabs on anyone. And yet somehow information about your ex will always end up finding its way to you. And it's like I can't concentrate while Lily's here because she's now part of his life."
"Perhaps you should just get in touch with him, dear. It sounds as if you still have things to say."
"I have nothing to say to him," I said. My voice grew impassioned. "I tried so hard, Margot. I wrote to him and sent him emails and called. Do you know he didn't write me one letter in 3 months? I asked if he would write because I thought it would be a really lovely way for us to stay connected, and we could learn things about each other and look forward to speaking and have something to remind us of our time apart, and he just wouldn't." She sat and watched me, her hands folded across the remote control. I straightened my shoulders. "But it's fine, because I've moved on, and Josh is just terrific. I mean, he's handsome, and he's kind, and he has this great job, and he's ambitious. Oh, he is so ambitious. And he's really going places, you know? He has things he wants, houses and career and giving things back. He wants to give back, and he hasn't even really got anything to give back yet." I sat down. Dean Martin stood in front of me, confused. "And he's totally clear that he wants to be with me. No ifs, no buts. He literally called me his girlfriend from our first date. And I've heard all about the serial daters in this town. Do you know how lucky that makes me feel?" She gave a small nod. I stood again. "So I don't really give a monkey's about Sam. I mean, we hardly even knew each other when I came over here. I suspect, if it hadn't been for each of us requiring emergency medical help, we might not have been together at all. In fact, I'm sure of it. And I plainly wasn't right for him, or he would have waited, right? Because that's what people do. So all in all, it's great. And I'm actually really happy with how everything's turned out. It's all good. All good." There was a short silence.
"So I see," said Margot.
quietly. I'm really happy.
I can see that, dear.
She watched me for a moment, then placed her hands on the arms of her chair.
Now, perhaps you could take that poor dog out. His eyes have started to bulge.
Chapter 25.
It took me 2 evenings to locate Margot's grandson. Josh was busy with work and Margot went to bed most nights by 9. So one evening, I sat on the floor by the front door, the one place where I could pick up the Gopnik's Wi-Fi, and I started Googling her, testing the name Frank DeWitt. And when nothing of that name came up, Frank Aldridge Jr. There was nobody who could have been him unless he'd moved to a different part of the country. But even then, the dates and nationalities of all the men who came up under that name were wrong. On the second night, on a whim, I looked up Margot's married name in some old papers that were in the chest of drawers in my room. I found a card for a funeral service for Terence Webber, so I tried Frank Webber, and discovered with some wistfulness that she had named her son after her beloved husband, who had died years before he was even born, and that some time further down the line she had changed her name back to her maiden name, DeWitt, and reinvented herself completely. Frank Webber Jr. was a dentist who lived somewhere called Tuckahoe in Westchester. I found a couple of references to him on LinkedIn and on Facebook through his wife, Lainey. The big news was that they had a son, Vincent, who was a little younger than me. He worked in Yonkers with a not-for-profit educational centre for underprivileged children, and it was he who decided it for me. Frank Webber Jr. might be too angry with his mother to rebuild a relationship, but what harm would there be in trying Vincent? I found his profile, took a breath, sent him a message, and waited. Josh took a break from his never-ending round of corporate jockeying and had lunch with me at the Noodle Bar, announcing there was a corporate family day the following Saturday at the Lurb Boathouse, and that he'd like me to come as his plus one. I was planning on going to the library protest.
You don't want to keep doing that, Louisa. You're not going to change anything, standing around with a bunch of people shouting at passing cars.
And I'm not really family, I said, bristling slightly.
Close enough. Come on, it'll be a great day. Have you ever been to the boathouse? It's gorgeous. My firm really knows how to lay on a party. You're still doing your say yes thing, right? So you have to say yes.
He did puppy eyes at me.
Say yes, Louisa, please. Go on.
He had me and he knew it. I smiled resignedly. Okay.
Yes. Great. Last year, apparently, they had all these inflatable sumo suits, and people wrestled on the grass, and there were family races and organized games. You're gonna love it.
Sounds amazing, I said. The words organized games held the same appeal to me as the words compulsory smear test. But it was Josh, and he looked so pleased at the thought of my accompanying him that I didn't have the heart to say no.
I promise you won't have to wrestle my workmates. You might have to wrestle me afterwards, though.
He said, kissed me, and left. I checked my inbox all week, but there was nothing other than an email from Lily asking if I knew the best place to get an underage tattoo. A friendly hello from someone who was apparently at school with me, but whom I didn't remember at all, and one from my mother sending me a gif of an overweight cat, apparently, talking to a 2-year-old, and a link to a game called Farm Fun Fandango.
Are you sure you'll be okay by yourself, Margot? I said as I gathered my keys and purse into my handbag.
I was wearing a white jumpsuit with gold lamé epaulettes and trim that she'd given me from her early 80s period, and she clasped her hands together.
Oh, that looks magnificent on you. You must have almost exactly the measurements that I had at the same age. I used to have a bust, you know. Terribly unfashionable in the 60s and 70s, but there you go.
I didn't like to tell her that it was taking everything I had not to burst her seams, but she was right. I had lost a few pounds since I'd moved in with her, mostly because of my efforts to cook her things that were nutritionally useful. I felt lovely in the jumpsuit and gave her a twirl.
Have you taken your pills? Of course I have. Don't fuss, dear. Does that mean you won't be back later?
I'm not sure. I'll take Dean Martin for a quick walk before I go, though, just in case. I paused as I reached for the dog's lead.
Margot, why did you call him Dean Martin? I've never asked.
The tone of her response told me it was an idiotic question.
Because Dean Martin was the most terrifically handsome man,
and he's the most terrifically handsome dog, of course.
The little dog sat obediently, his bulging, mismatched eyes rolling above his flapping tongue. "Silly of me to ask," I said, and let myself out of the front door.
"Well, look at you!" Ashok whistled as Dean Martin and I ran down the last flight of stairs to the ground floor. "Disco diva!"
"You like it?" I said, throwing a shape in front of him. It was Margot's.
"Seriously? That woman is full of surprises.
Watch out for her, will you? She's pretty wobbly today."
"Kept back a piece of mail, just so I have an excuse to knock on her door at 6 o'clock. You're a star."
We jogged outside to the park, and Dean Martin did what dogs do. And I did what you do with a little bag and a certain amount of shuddering, and various passers-by stared in the way you do if you see a girl in a lamé-trimmed jumpsuit running around with an excitable dog and a small bag of poo. It was as we sprinted back in, Dean Martin yapping delightedly at my heels, that we bumped into Josh in the lobby.
"Oh, hey," I said, kissing him. "I'll be 2 minutes, okay? Just have to wash my hands and grab my handbag."
"Grab your handbag?"
"Yes,"
I gazed at him.
"Oh, purse. You call it a purse." "I just meant you're not getting changed."
I looked down at my jumpsuit.
"I am changed."
"Sweetheart, if you wear that to our office day out, they're going to wonder if you're the entertainment." It took me a moment to realize he wasn't joking.
"You don't like it?"
"Oh, no. You look great. It's just kind of a bit
drag queeny."
"We're an office full of suits. Like, the other wives and girlfriends will be in shift dresses or white pants. It's just smart casual."
"Oh."
I tried not to feel disappointed.
"Sorry, I don't really get US dress codes."
Okay, wait there. I'll be right back." I took the stairs two at a time and burst into Margot's apartment, throwing Dean Martin's lead towards Margot, who had got up out of her chair for something, and now followed me down the hallway, one thin arm braced against the wall.
"Why are you in such a tearing hurry? You sound like a herd of elephants charging around the apartment."
"I have to change."
"Change? Why?"
"I'm not suitable, apparently." I rattled my way through my wardrobe. Shift dresses? The only shift dress I had was the psychedelic one Sam had given me, and it felt somehow disloyal to wear that.
"I thought you looked very nice," said Margot, pointedly.
Josh appeared at the open front door, having made his way up behind me.
"Oh, she does. She looks great. I just want her to be talked about for the right reasons."
He laughed. Margot didn't laugh back. I rifled through my wardrobe, throwing things onto my bed, until I found my navy Gucci-style blazer and a striped silk shirt dress. I threw that over my head and slid my feet into my green Mary Janes.
"How's that?" I said as I ran into the hallway trying to straighten my hair.
"Great," he said, unable to hide his relief.
"Okay, let's go."
"I'll leave the door unlocked, dear,"
I heard Margot mutter as I ran after Josh, who was headed out.
"Just in case you want to come back."
The Lurb Boathouse was a beautiful venue, sheltered by its position from the noise and chaos outside Central Park, its vast windows offering a panoramic view of the lake, glinting in the afternoon sun. It was packed with smartly dressed men in identikit chinos, women with professionally blow-dried hair, and was, as Josh had predicted, a sea of pastels and white trousers. I took a glass of champagne from a tray being proffered by a waiter and watched quietly while Josh worked the room, glad-handing various men, who all seemed to look the same, with their short, neat haircuts and square jaws with even white teeth. I had a brief memory of events I had been to with Agnes. I had fallen into my other New York world again, a world away from the vintage clothes stores and mothballed jumpers and cheap coffee I had been immersed in more recently. I took a long sip of my champagne, deciding to embrace it. Josh appeared beside me.
"Quite something, isn't it?"
"It's very beautiful."
"Better than sitting in some old woman's apartment all afternoon, huh?"
"Well, I don't think I..." "My boss is coming. Okay, I'm going to introduce you. Stay with me."
"Mitchell!"
Josh lifted an arm, and the older man walked over slowly, a statuesque brunette woman at his side, her smile oddly blank. Perhaps if you had to be nice to everyone all the time, that was what eventually happened to your face.
"Are you enjoying the afternoon?"
"Very much so, sir," Josh said.
What a truly beautiful setting. May I introduce my girlfriend? This is Louisa Clark from England. Louisa, this is Mitchell Dumont. He's head of mergers and acquisitions. English, eh? I felt the man's huge hand close over mine and shake it emphatically. Yes, I...
Good, good.
He turned back to Josh. So, young man, I hear you're making quite a splash in your department. Josh couldn't hide his delight. His smile spread across his face. His eyes flickered to me and then to the woman beside me, and I realized he was expecting me to make conversation with her. Nobody had bothered to introduce us. Mitchell Dumont put a paternal arm around Josh's shoulders and walked him a few feet away. So, I said. I raised my eyebrows and lowered them again. She smiled blankly at me. I love your dress, I said, the universal smoother for two women who have absolutely nothing to say to each other.
Thank you. Cute shoes, she said.
But she said it in a way that meant they weren't cute at all. She glanced over, plainly wondering if she could find someone else to talk to. She had taken one look at my outfit and deemed herself way beyond my pay grade. There was nobody else nearby, so I tried again. So, do you come here a lot? To the Loeb Boathouse, I mean.
It's Loeb, she said.
Loeb?
You pronounced it Loeb.
It's Loeb. Looking at her perfectly made-up, suspiciously plump lips repeatedly saying the word made me want to giggle. I took a swig of my champagne to disguise it.
So do you kerm to the Loeb Boathouse often? I said, unable to help myself.
No, she said, although one of my friends got married here last year.
That was such a beautiful wedding.
I'll bet. And what do you do? I'm a homemaker.
A hermmaker? My mother is also a hermmaker.
I took another long sip of my drink.
Her making is perfectly lovely.
I saw Josh, his face focused intently on his boss's, reminding me briefly of Tom's, when he was pleading with Dad to give him some of his crisps. The woman's expression had become faintly concerned, or as far as a woman who couldn't move her brow could express concern. A bubble of giggles had started to build in my chest, and I pleaded with some unseen deity to keep them under control.
Maya! Her voice tinged with relief. Mrs. Dumont, at least I assumed that was whom I'd been talking to, waved at a woman approaching us, her perfect figure neatly pinned into a mint-coloured shift dress.
I waited while they air-kissed.
You look simply gorgeous. As do you. I love that dress. Oh, it's so old, and you're so sweet. How's that darling husband of yours? Always talking business.
Oh, you know Mitchell. Mrs. Dumont plainly couldn't ignore my presence any longer.
This is Joshua Ryan's girlfriend. I'm so sorry, I missed your name. Terribly noisy in here.
Louisa, I said.
How lovely, I'm Chrissy. I'm Jeffrey's other half. You know Jeffrey in sales and marketing?
Oh, everyone knows Jeffrey, said Mrs. Dumont.
Oh, Jeffrey, I said, shaking my head, then nodding, then shaking my head again. And what do you do?
What do I do?
Louisa's in fashion.
Josh appeared at my side.
You certainly do have an individual look. I love the British, don't you, Mallory? They are so interesting in their choices.
There was a brief silence while everyone digested my choices.
Louisa's about to start work at Women's Wear Daily.
You are? Said Mallory Dumont.
I am, I said. Yes, I am. Well, that must be just thrilling. What a wonderful magazine. I must find my husband. Do excuse me.
With another bland smile, she walked off on her vertiginous heels, Maya beside her.
Why did you say that? I said, reaching for another glass of champagne. It sounds better than I house-sit an old lady.
No, you just look like you might work in fashion.
You're still uncomfortable with what I'm wearing.
I looked over at the two women in their complimentary dresses. I had a sudden memory of how Agnes must have felt at such gatherings, the myriad subtle ways women can find to let other women know they do not fit in.
You look great. It just makes it easier to explain your particular, unique sensibility if they think you're in fashion. Which you kind of are.
I'm perfectly happy with what I do, Josh.
But you want to work in fashion, don't you? You can't look after an old woman forever. Look, I was going to tell you after,
My sister-in-law, Debbie, she knows a woman in the marketing department at Women's Wear Daily. She said she's going to ask them to find out if they have any entry-level vacancies. She seems pretty confident she can do something for you. What do you say?
He was beaming, like he'd presented me with the Holy Grail. I took a swig of my drink.
Sure. There you go! Exciting!
He kept looking at me, eyebrows raised.
Yay!
I said finally. He squeezed my shoulder.
I knew you'd be happy. Right, let's get back out there. It's the family races next.
Want a lime and soda?
I don't think we can really be seen to be drinking more than one glass of champagne.
Here, let me take that for you. He put my glass on the tray of a passing waiter, and we headed out into the sunshine. Given the elegance of the occasion and the spectacular nature of the setting, I should really have enjoyed the next couple of hours. I had said yes to a new experience after all. But in truth, I felt increasingly out of place among the corporate couples. The conversational rhythms eluded me so that when I was pulled into a casual group, I ended up seeming either mute or stupid. Josh moved from person to person like a guided managerial missile. At every stop, his face eager and engaged, his manner polished and assertive. I found myself watching him and wondering, again, what on earth he saw in me. I was nothing like these women, with their glowing peach-coloured limbs and their uncreasable dresses, their tales of impossible nannies and holidays in the Bahamas. I followed in his wake, repeating his lie about my nascent fashion career, and smiling mutely, and agreeing that yes, yes, it is very beautiful, and thank you. Oh, yes, I'd love another glass of champagne, and trying not to notice Josh's bobbing eyebrow.
How are you enjoying the day?
A woman with a red-haired bob, so shiny it was almost mirrored, stood beside me as Josh laughed uproariously at the joke of some older man in a pale blue shirt and chinos.
Oh, it's great. Thank you.
I had become very good by then at smiling and saying nothing at all.
Felicity Lieberman. I work two desks away from Josh. He's doing really well.
I shook her hand. Louisa Clark.
He certainly is.
I stepped back and took another sip of my drink.
He'll make partner within 2 years, I'm certain of it.
You two been dating long?
Not that long, but we've known each other a lot longer.
She seemed to be waiting for me to say more.
Well, we were sort of friends before.
I had drunk too much and found myself talking more than I had intended.
I was actually with someone else, but Josh and I kept bumping into each other.
Well, he says he was waiting for me, or waiting until me and my ex split up. It was actually kind of romantic, and a bunch of stuff happened then. Bang! Suddenly we were in a relationship. You know how these things go.
Oh, I do. He's very persuasive, is our Josh.
There was something in her laugh that unsettled me.
Persuasive? I said after a moment.
So, did he do the whispering gallery on you?
Did he what?
She must have caught my look of shock. She leant towards me.
Felicity Lieberman, you are the cutest girl in New York.
She glanced at Josh, then backtracked.
Oh, don't look like that. We weren't serious. And Josh really does like you. He talks about you a lot at work. He's definitely serious. But jeez, these men and their moves, right?
I tried to laugh.
Right.
By the time Mr. Dumont had made a self-congratulatory speech and couples had begun to float off to their homes, I was sinking under an early hangover. Josh held open the door of a waiting taxi, but I said I'd walk.
You don't want to come back to mine? We could grab a bite to eat.
I'm tired, and Margaret has an appointment in the morning, I said. My cheeks were aching from all the fake smiling. His eyes searched my face.
You're mad at me.
I'm not mad at you.
You're mad at me because of what I said about your job.
He took my hand.
Louisa, I didn't mean to upset you, sweetheart.
But you wanted me to be someone else.
You thought I was beneath them.
No, I think you're great. It's just you could do better because you have so much potential, and I
don't say that, okay? The potential thing. It's patronizing and it's insulting and,
well, I don't want you to say it to me ever, okay?
Whoa!
Josh glanced behind him, perhaps checking to see if any work colleagues were watching. He took my elbow.
Okay, so what's really going on here?
I stared at my feet.
I didn't want to say anything, but I couldn't stop myself.
How many?
How many what?
How many women have you done that thing to? The whispering gallery.
It threw him. He rolled his eyes and briefly turned away.
Felicity.
Yeah, Felicity.
So you're not the first, but it's a nice thing, right? I thought you'd enjoy it. Look, I just wanted to make you smile.
We stood on each side of the door as the taxi meter ticked, and the driver raised his eyes to the rearview mirror, waiting.
And it did make you smile, right?
We had a moment.
Didn't we have a moment?
But you'd already had that moment. With someone else.
Come on, Louisa. Am I the only ever man you've ever said nice things to? Dressed up for? Made love to?
We're not teenagers. We've got history.
And tried and tested moves.
That's not fair.
I took a breath.
I'm sorry. It's not just a whispering gallery thing. I find these events a little tricky. I'm not used to having to pretend to be someone I'm not.
His smile returned, his face softening.
Hey, you'll get there. They're nice people once you know them.
Even the ones I've dated.
He tried to smile.
If you say so.
We'll go on one of the softball days. That's a bit lower key. You'll love it.
I raised a smile. He leant forward and kissed me.
We okay? He said.
We're okay.
You sure you don't want to come back with me?
I need to check on Margot. Plus, I've got a headache.
That's what you get for knocking it back. Drink lots of water. It's probably dehydration. I'll speak to you tomorrow.
He kissed me, climbed into the taxi and closed the door. As I stood there watching, he waved, then tapped twice on the screen to send the taxi forward. I checked the clock in the lobby when I arrived back and was surprised to find it was only 6:30. The afternoon seemed to have lasted several decades. I removed my shoes, feeling the utter relief that only a woman knows when pinched toes are finally allowed to sink into deep pile carpet, and walked up to Margot's apartment barefoot with them dangling from my hand. I felt weary and cross in a way I couldn't quite articulate, like I'd been asked to play a game whose rules I didn't understand. I'd actually felt as if I'd rather be anywhere else than where I was. And I kept thinking about Felicity Lieberman's. Did he do the whispering gallery on you? As I walked through the door, I stooped to greet Dean Martin, who bounced his way up the hall to me. His squished little face was so delighted at my return that it was hard to stay grumpy. I sat down on the hall floor and let him jump around me, snuffling to reach my face with his pink tongue, until I was smiling again.
"It's just me, Margot," I called.
"Well, I hardly thought it was George Clooney,"
came the response.
"More's the pity for me.
How were the Stepford wives? Has he converted you yet?" "It was a lovely afternoon, Margot," I lied. "Everyone was very nice."
"That bad, huh? Would you mind fetching me a nice little vermouth if you happen to be passing the kitchen, dear?"
"What the hell is vermouth?" I muttered to the dog, but he sat down to scratch one of his ears with his hind leg.
"Have one yourself, if you like," she added. "I suspect you'll be in need of it."
I was just climbing to my feet when my phone rang. I felt a momentary dismay. It would probably be Josh, and I wasn't quite ready to talk to him. But when I checked the screen, it was my home number. I pressed the phone to my ear.
"Dad?"
"Louisa?"
"Oh, thank goodness."
I checked my watch. Is everything okay? It must be the middle of the night there.
"Sweetheart, I've got bad news."
"It's your granddad." Chapter 26. In memory of Albert John Compton, Granddad. Funeral service, St. Mary and All Saints Parish Church, Stortford Green, 23rd of April, 12:30 p.m. All welcome for refreshments afterwards at the Laughing Dog Public House on Pinemouth Street. No flowers, but any donations welcome to the Injured Jockeys Fund. Our hearts are empty, but we are blessed to have loved you. 3 days later, I flew home in time for the funeral. I cooked Margot 10 days' worth of meals, froze them, and left instructions with Ashok that he was to sneak up to her apartment at least once a day, on a pretext, and make sure that she was okay, or that if she wasn't, I wouldn't walk in a week later to a health hazard. I postponed one of her hospital appointments and picked up her prescriptions, made sure she had clean sheets, that Dean Martin had enough food, and paid Magda, a professional dog walker, to come twice a day.
I told Margot firmly that she was not to sack her on day one. I told the girls at the Vintage Clothes Emporium that I would be away. I saw Josh twice. I let him stroke my hair and tell me he was sorry, and that he remembered how it felt to lose his own grandfather. It was only when I was finally on the plane that I realized the myriad ways I had made myself busy had been a way not to acknowledge the truth of what had just happened. Granddad was gone. Another stroke, Dad said. He and Mum had been sitting in the kitchen chatting while Granddad watched the racing, and she had come in to ask if he wanted a top-up of tea, and he had slipped away. So quietly and peacefully that 15 minutes had passed before it dawned on them that he wasn't just asleep. "He looked so relaxed, Lou," he said as we travelled back from the airport in his van. "His head was just on one side and his eyes were closed, like he was taking a nap. I mean, God love him. We none of us wanted to lose him, but that would be the way to go, wouldn't it? In your favourite chair, in your own house, with the old telly on. He didn't even have a bet on that race, so it's not like he'd be headed up to the hereafter feeling gutted that he'd missed out on his winnings." He tried to smile. I felt numb. It was only when I followed Dad into our house and saw the empty chair that I was able to convince myself it was true. I would never see him again. Never feel that curved old back under my fingertips as I hugged him. Never again make him a cup of tea, or interpret his silent words, or joke with him about cheating at Sudoku. "Oh, Lou!" Mum came down the corridor and pulled me to her. I hugged her, feeling her tears seep into my shoulder, while Dad stood behind her, patting her back and muttering, "There, there, love, you're all right. You're all right." As if saying it enough times would make it so. Much as I loved Grandad, I had sometimes wondered, abstractly, if when he finally went, Mum would feel in some way freed from the responsibility of caring for him. Her life had been so firmly tied to his for so long that she had only ever been able to carve out little bits of time for herself. His last months of poor health had meant she could no longer even go to her beloved night classes. But I was wrong. She was bereft, permanently on the edge of tears. She berated herself for not having been in the room when he had gone, welled up at the sight of his belongings, and fretted constantly over whether she could have done more. She was restless, lost without someone to care for. She got up and she sat down, plumping cushions, checking a clock for some mythical appointment. When she was really unhappy, she cleaned manically, wiping non-existent dust from skirting and scrubbing floors until her knuckles were red and raw. In the evenings we sat around the kitchen table while Dad went to the pub, supposedly to sort the last of the arrangements for the funeral tea, and she tipped away the fourth cup she had made by accident for a man who was no longer there. She blurted out the questions that had haunted her since he had died. "What if I could have done something? What if we had taken him to the hospital for more tests? They might have been able to pick up on the risk of more strokes." Her hands twisted together over her handkerchief. "But you did all those things. You took him to millions of appointments. Do you remember that time he ate 2 packets of chocolate digestives? That might have been the thing that did it. Sugar's the devil's work now, by all accounts. I should have put them on a higher shelf. I shouldn't have let him eat all those wretched cakes. He wasn't a child, Mum. I should have made him eat his greens. But it was hard, you know. You can't spoon-feed an adult. Oh, Lord, no offence. I mean, with Will, obviously it was different." I put my hand over hers and watched her face crumple. "Nobody could have loved him more, Mum. Nobody could have cared for Grandad better than you did." In truth, her grief made me feel uncomfortable. It was too close to a place I had been, and not that long ago. I was wary of her sadness, as if it was contagious, and found myself looking for excuses to stay away from her, trying to keep myself busy so that I didn't have to absorb it too. That night, when Mum and Dad sat going over some paperwork from the solicitor, I went to Grandad's room. It was still just as he'd left it. The bed made, the copy of the racing post on the chair, 2 races for the following afternoon circled with blue biro. I sat on the side of the bed, tracing the pattern on the candlewick counterpane with my index finger. On the bedside table stood a picture of my grandmother in the 1950s, her hair set in rolled waves, her smile open and trusting. I had only fleeting memories of her,
But my grandfather had been a constant fixture in my childhood. First in the little house along the street. Trina and I would run down there for sweets on Saturday afternoon as my mother stood at the gate. And then, for the last 15 years, in a room at our house. His sweet, wavering smile the punctuation to my day. A permanent presence in the living room with his newspaper and a mug of tea. I thought about the stories he would tell us when we were small, of his time in the Navy. The ones about desert islands and monkeys and coconut trees might not have been entirely true. About the eggy bread he would fry in the blackened pan, the only thing he could cook, and how, when I was really small, he would tell my grandmother jokes that made her weep with laughter. And then I thought about his later years, when I treated him almost as part of the furniture. I hadn't written to him. I hadn't called him. I had just assumed he would be there for as long as I wanted him to be. Had he minded? Had he wanted to speak to me? I hadn't even said goodbye. I remembered Agnes's words, that we who travelled far from home would always have our hearts in two places. I placed my hand on the candlewick bedspread, and finally I wept. On the day of the funeral, I came downstairs to find Mum cleaning furiously, in preparation for the funeral guests, even though, to my knowledge, nobody was coming back to the house. Dad sat at the table looking faintly out of his depth, not an unusual expression when he was talking to my mother these days. "You don't need to get a job, Josie. You don't need to do anything." "Well, I need something to do with my time." Mum took off her jacket and folded it carefully over the back of a chair, before going down on her knees to get at some invisible speck of dirt behind a cupboard. Dad wordlessly pushed a plate and knife towards me.
"I was just saying, Lou. Love, your mother doesn't need to jump into anything. She's saying she's headed to the job centre after the service."
"You looked after Grandad for years, Mum. You should just enjoy having some time to yourself."
"No, I'm better if I'm doing something." "We'll have no cupboards left if she keeps scrubbing them at this rate,"
Dad muttered. "Sit down, please. You need to eat something."
"I'm not hungry." "For God's sake, woman, you'll give me a stroke if you carry on like this."
He winced as soon as he'd said it.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean..."
"Mum." I walked over to her when she didn't appear to hear me. I put my hand on her shoulder and she briefly stilled. "Mum." She pushed herself to her feet and looked out of the window.
"What use am I now?" she said.
"What do you mean?" She adjusted the starched white net curtain.
"Nobody needs me any more."
"Oh, Mum, I need you. We all need you.
But you're not here, are you?"
"None of you is, not even Tom.
You're all miles away."
Dad and I exchanged a look. "Doesn't mean we don't need you. Grandad was the only one who relied on me.
Even you, Bernard. You'd be fine with a pie and a pint up the road every evening.
What am I supposed to do now? I'm 58 years old and I'm good for nothing. I've spent my whole life looking